Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. For the next 5 days, we are engaging in an original investigation into not just the misrepresentations of scientific facts and medical myths involving the coronavirus, but more importantly, we have uncovered a great deal of information about the people who are supporting the political and scientific direction that we are going. We have a lot of people listening today who are very concerned. They're concerned about a virus that we were originally led to believe will impact the whole world. It can infect anyone with deadly consequences. And therefore, that social distancing and sanitation, proper hygiene, and wearing masks, and being at home were absolutely necessary. Not an unreasonable request of the public if indeed all of their assumptions were true and could be supported. Here is the problem, that almost nothing that they've been telling us at face value can be accepted. We will give you the most comprehensive, in-depth analysis of what is going on with coronavirus, information you have not heard before. We will go through point by point with actual science. We will quote the actual professors of virology and professors of medicine from around the world. We will show you, for example, a leading parliamentarian in Italy denouncing the government for its policies, considering that the actual statistics show that 97% of the people who had died did not die because of the coronavirus, but had died because of comorbidities. And yet he stood up. Wouldn't it be nice if we had someone with that courage in the American Congress? Right now, we do not. But we do have physicians. We have people who historically have agreed with whatever the political and scientific consensus was, who are now breaking ranks. We will be bringing you their information. We have a special, in-depth, original investigative report that we'll be revealing to you on Wednesday of this week. Each day we'll be playing you videos that deconstruct a methodical scholarship, who the people behind this entire direction that we're taking are. And it's not who you might think. The media has been complicit. They certainly have the intellect, the education, and the resources to do the same reporting we're doing. So why haven't they and why won't they? Why is social media, Facebook, Google, and all the others, including and especially Wikipedia, why are they the problem and not the solution? Why are they engaged in active censorship? Why hasn't the ACLU and other organizations that I have enormous respect for what they've taken on, even issues I disagree with, but they needed to take them on for all of us? Why are they not on our side, the people's side, on this? Frequently when it comes to medical and scientific issues, people who are not scientists or physicians will defer to those who are. And the more significant the person's reputation and position within a scientific body, such as the National Academy of Sciences, or an editor-in-chief at a magazine such as the Journal of the American Medical Association, the Lancet, British Medical Journal, or a head, even more so, the head of an agency such as the CDC or the FDA or U.S. Public Health Services that oversees all of those agencies like the National Cancer Institute and the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease. While his employees, including over 2 million scientists, why is there only one scientist coming forward to be the official spokesperson, Dr. Anthony Fauci? Have any of the journalists in America gone back to look at how he mishandled, misguided, and deceived the public, he and Robert Gallo, when it came to HIV and AIDS? And what did that cost in lives? No journalist, except those who have had the courage to do, say the Charles Ortliebs, Nina Ostroms, and Celia Farbers, those who went into that belly of the beast, looked at the mess, and then wrote their very significant articles. You go back and read what they wrote about the association between HIV infection, who was most susceptible, the drugs to treat it, the test to take, and you'll see they were correct. The establishment was dead wrong. And when I say dead, I mean deadly for those who were HIV infected and would therefore go through the orthodox treatment. The very people who ran that fiasco are running the COVID. So we're not going to do health this week. We are going to give you more information than you've ever gotten up to this point, more resources, and more of the story. We're going to show you who the five most important people are controlling everything behind the scenes. We begin, however, with a report from, and time permitting today, we'll have Chris Hedges on to give his color commentary on the COVID pandemic and what we can learn about government overreach on this. Oh, yes, we will be playing you the clip of the woman in Australia. She's a nurse, and her four-year-old son, who were really manhandled and brutalized yesterday. You can see the woman arresting her, not just one, but a whole gang of police in Australia arresting her and ripping her son apart, and then taking a four-year-old boy to question. Since when is it acceptable for the police en masse, fully armed, to take a four-year-old child away from the mother and then interrogate a four-year-old boy? Is that what you've come to, Australia? You've been there. You already censor. You're a disgusting country in your body politic, not your people, the politicians, but it's true all over the world, and especially so, no more so than in the United States. We are now a fully police state. The police have been militarized under Barack Obama, under George Bush, under Donald Trump, and it's getting worse. So if those of you in this audience think this report is not important, then think of Germany in 1932. Before the SS, you had the brown shirts under Rome. And he was notorious for carrying out orders of destroying, arresting, interrogating. Well, now America has this 1932 moment. If it goes further, you can only anticipate the breach of our constitutional and Bill of Rights freedoms that will be usurped. Now you're going to know who's behind it. And our scholarship is out there. Nothing is hidden. Nothing is opaque. Everything is there for you to document. We begin with a series of comments, only one today. This is from Tucker Carlson. I can agree or disagree with him on different views, and I do. But a friend of mine who is a lifelong liberal, one of the most important liberal voices in America, he is one of the senior, well, let's say that he is one of the senior wise men, along with the senior wise women, who have been there for at least 60 years in all the major efforts to maintain and protect our freedoms. And he sent me an interesting email. And the email came in yesterday, and he said, Gary, Tucker Carlson is not one of my favorite people, but these three clips are very good and very scary. We will play you these three clips. The first begins right now, and it's about big tech censors' dissent over coronavirus lockdowns. And why am I going to play this? Because I know of no other journalist, certainly not the cowards on PBS, certainly not the people who've been bought and paid for. And we're going to show you who owns the content on NBC and on NPR and on PBS. We're actually going to show you the financial connections, how much money they get, who gives them the money, how does it get transferred. All that we're revealing. I'm telling you, you're not going to hear a five-day investigative report like this anywhere else. But it was only Tucker Carlson who has had the courage to face the establishment. He'll probably be purged, because he's alienated and gone after the right and left. He's gone after the Koch brothers and the libertarians. He's gone after Trey Gowdy. Interesting, because Sean Hannity had Trey Gowdy on praising him, and Tucker Carlson condemned him in the program before. When you do that on Fox, you know your days are limited. That's my opinion. I hope it's not the case, because he's the one who had on Robert F. Kennedy when no one else would have on Robert F. Kennedy. So I thank him for his courage. Now, two, big tech censors dissent on the coronavirus lockdowns, and then we're going to go to a devastating report on Bill Gates.
Governor Tucker Carlson tonight. Last night on this show, we played you a clip from a nearly hour-long video produced by two physicians in California, Drs. Dan Erickson and Artin Masihi. Likely many of you had already seen it. That video has had more than 5 million views on YouTube. In their presentation, the two doctors presented a flurry of data pointing to what we are currently learning about this virus and how it spreads. They recited pages of government statistics and then interpreted them in light of their own experience as doctors. At one point, they noted that the newly adjusted death rate in their state of California, which is much lower than anyone expected it to be, and they asked if government officials there should change their policies based on this new science. Watch.
We've seen 1,227 deaths in the state of California with a possible incidence or prevalence of 4.7 million. That means you have a 0.03 chance of dying from COVID-19 in the state of California. 0.03 chance of dying from COVID in the state of California. Does that necessitate sheltering in place? Does that necessitate shutting down medical systems? Does that necessitate people being out of work?
So whatever your view of the mass quarantines, and maybe you're enthusiastically for them, the questions you just heard are valid questions. In fact, they're critical questions. We should all be asking those questions, including and especially our policymakers. But as Dr. Erickson pointed out later in the video, dissent of any kind is no longer tolerated in this country. Fact-based honesty, which is the soul of science, is under attack, even in hospitals. Dr. Erickson described physicians being pressured to classify illnesses and deaths as related to coronavirus, whether they believe that to be true or not.
We aren't pressured to test for flu, but ER doctors now, my friends that I talk to say, you know, it's interesting, when I'm writing up my death report, I'm being pressured to add COVID. Why is that? Why are we being pressured to add COVID to maybe increase the numbers and make it look a little bit worse than it is? I think so.
So what you just heard, what Dr. Erickson described, is called lying. And lying has no place in science ever. It's scary to think it takes place on a large scale in hospitals. He says it does. Viewers of Erickson's video were shocked and transfixed by this. They forwarded the video to friends who forwarded it on to their friends. And suddenly, millions of people who have spent the last 6 weeks on a diet of Tiger King and internet memes were watching sober-minded medical researchers reading from charts of statistics. It's hard to recall a science video taking off like this one did. Not everyone was impressed by it. Some criticized the doctor's policy conclusions. And of course, that's fair. Decent people have different opinions. We're not entirely certain what the perfect response to this pandemic is. Nobody is certain. There's no objective answer at the moment. At best, we can plod along with open minds and good faith. More informed debate is exactly what we need to make wise decisions going forward. Unfortunately for all of us, informed debate is exactly what the authorities don't want. They want unquestioned obedience, so they're cracking down on free expression. Last night, the doctor's video, the one you just saw, was pulled off of YouTube, the largest video hosting site in the world. It wasn't an accident. YouTube admitted doing it. The company cited a violation of, quote, community guidelines, and they did not apologize. Looking back, when all of this is finally over, and it will be, it's likely we'll see this moment, what YouTube just did, as a turning point in the way we live in this country, a sharp break with 250 years of law and custom. The two doctors' video was produced by a local television channel in California. It was, in effect, a mainstream news story. The video was not pornographic, it didn't violate copyright or incite violence or commit libel, it didn't break any law. The only justification for taking it down was that the two physicians on screen had reached different conclusions from the people currently in charge. It was a form of dissent from orthodoxy. YouTube and its parent company, Google, have now officially banned dissent. The CEO of YouTube admitted that openly.
But then we also talk about removing information that is problematic. You know, of course, anything that is medically unsubstantiated, so people saying, like, take vitamin C, take turmeric, like, those are all will cure you. Those are the examples of things that would be a violation of our policy. Anything that would go against World Health Organization recommendations would be a violation of our policy. And so remove is another really important part of our policy.
So you're not just putting the truth next to the lie, you're taking the lie down. That's a pretty aggressive approach.
Removing, quote, anything that would go against World Health Organization recommendations. It'll now be taken off the internet. Consider that for a minute. As a matter just of science, it's ludicrous. Like everyone else involved in global pandemic policy, the WHO has often been wrong in its recommendations. A lot of people have. In mid-January, WHO told us that coronavirus could not spread from person to person. In March, they told us that face masks didn't work. Those were lies, and they were welcome on Google's platforms. Doctors who are actually treating patients with the virus, meanwhile, have just been banned. So no, this is not about science. Censorship never is about science. It's about power. Big technology companies are using this tragedy to increase their power over the American population. They're working in concert with politicians in order to do it. Just today, Facebook removed an events page for a political protest in Michigan. Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who runs that state, was no doubt pleased to see it. Grossly mismanaging an entire state is a lot easier when citizens are not allowed to complain about it, and now they're not. Last week, Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg explained that protests like these are no longer protected political speech. They're, quote, misinformation.
How do you deal with the fact that Facebook is now being used to organize a lot of these protests to defy social distancing, defy the social distancing guidelines in states? Is somebody trying to organize something like that, does that qualify as harmful information?
We do classify that as harmful misinformation, and we take that down.
Harmful misinformation. That is a phrase familiar to anyone who has watched totalitarian regimes in any country. It's now how Mark Zuckerberg describes political opinions he doesn't like. Our free press exists to push back against obvious abuses of power like this one. It's the reason we have a First Amendment. It's the only reason we have a First Amendment. But suddenly our media are not concerned about freedom of speech. Reporters applaud our overlords as they punish us for disagreeing. You just saw it in that clip from CNN. That happens every day. Our media are no longer challenging power. They are colluding with power. And that may be why there's been so little critical coverage of the massive expansion of our surveillance state currently in progress. In the name of fighting the coronavirus, tech companies are now following you through your cell phone. They're watching you from above with drones. Those sound like paranoid fantasies. They are not. It's happening as we speak. Needless to say, our politicians approve of this.
How do you feel about the drones?
Look, at this point, we need to save lives, and it's really important that in public spaces, people are abiding by the directives.
Yeah, we've got to do it. So what do we have here? We have big companies partnering with the government to spy on you without your knowledge. Americans locked in their homes, banned from going to church, placated with sedatives like weed and beer. Anyone who speaks up is silenced. Political demonstrations are illegal. Organizers are arrested. Only opinions approved by leaders, many of them unelected, are allowed on information platforms. Does that sound familiar? It sounds a lot like China. Of all the many ironies of this moment, so many of them bitter, the hardest to swallow is this one. As we fight this virus, we are becoming far more like the country that spawned it. We are becoming more like China. It's horrifying. And it tells you everything that our professional class enthusiastically welcomes this. Over the weekend, The Atlantic magazine published an article by two academics calling for an end to freedom of speech in America. Their model for an ideal system, the totalitarian government of China. Quote, in the debate over freedom versus control of the internet, China was largely correct and the U.S. was wrong, end quote. You ought to read the whole thing. Truly, you should. It's the future. We could quote from it from the rest of the show, but we'll give you just one more. Quote, significant monitoring and speech control are inevitable components of a mature and flourishing internet, and governments must play a large role in these practices to ensure that the internet is compatible with society's norms and values. End quote. Norms and values. whose norms and values? Well, our leaders' norms and values, of course, but mostly their interests. Those in power are the ones our professional class seeks to protect, not the rest of the country. Freedom of conscience never endangers the public. It only threatens the powerful.
Now, that's not all of the clip, but we have a lot to get to. But that gives you the message, and he is absolutely correct. By the way, the New York Times, working with the World Health Organization, has made any person, and that's about 4 to 5 million people in the United States alone, who have suffered from a vaccine injury or even a serious vaccine death, that you're now the enemy. In fact, in the top 10 health hazards and major health hazards in the world, dissenting from accepting a vaccine is now makes you one of the 10 top most dangerous situations in the world. And everyone in America was pro-vaccine until after their injuries. And yet the New York Times will not listen to the stories of the medical doctors whose own children, pediatricians who I've interviewed and filmed, whose own children they personally vaccinated, who then became autistic. Nobody wants to hear their stories because that would be an authority figure, a highly qualified authority figure, the ultimate person who is the authority, which is the pediatrician, about vaccine safety for the children that they see, and lots of them coming forward and saying, I will not vaccinate my child, my next child, based upon what has happened to this child. That person becomes an enemy of the state. And then all that you're seeing now is anyone challenging the safety and efficacy of vaccine from the past is now considered the person most likely to resist a vaccine in the future. And you know where all this is going. Mandatory COVID experimental vaccines. And oh, by the way, we will go into how experimental they are. We managed to track down and collect all other scientific research that was publicly available on how disastrous all the vaccines are, every single one, including the ones Fauci has authorized and funded. And we'll show you all that. We'll also show you how many patents Fauci owns and therefore profits from. Now we're going to play you a segment before Chris Hedges. And this is showing you three parts, part one today, and then it just gets worse, of who Bill Gates actually is. And he's behind everything. He is quite simply the most powerful person on the planet. He dwarfs the power of the president of the United States or any other country. And we can thank James Corbett for doing outstanding research on this. So you're going to watch this for the first time. Now, if you want to watch this, not just listen to it, please right now, in this moment, go to your computer and go prn.fm, and you can watch it. Now we go to the corporate report where we're going to show you the background on Bill Gates, information you did not know about him beyond the spin machine, beyond the enormous rewriting of his biography and history and whitewashing all of his indiscretions and misjudgments. You're going to see the real Bill Gates. Then in part two, we have methodically put together every medical and scientific university that he has given hundreds of millions of dollars to, some billions collectively, and he's made almost $100 billion for himself in the process. He's now right up there neck and neck with Jeff Bezos. So it can't be money that he and his wife wants. It's power. And he's not a medical doctor. He's not a scientist, not even a college graduate. But now he becomes the person that tells us what our health should be. And you'll hear in his own words, because we have information from his talks and his conferences to show you what he really thinks. So they can't scrub this, and they can't photo touch it to make it look better than what it is. This is the man who's behind what we're doing with the COVID virus, and he's funded the research on the COVID virus. So he will have the vaccines and the patents and profit from the COVID virus, hundreds of billions of dollars. But will he take responsibility in India and other countries for what his vaccines have done to the population? Yeah, we have all the details and statistics in India and in other countries. Now to the Corbett Report on who is really Bill Gates.
Microsoft. In this video, you're going to see the future.
Who is Bill Gates? A software developer? A businessman? A philanthropist? A global health expert? This question, once merely academic, is becoming a very real question for those who are beginning to realize that Gates' unimaginable wealth has been used to gain control over every corner of the fields of public health, medical research, and vaccine development. And now that we are presented with the very problem that Gates has been talking about for years, we will soon find that this software developer with no medical training is going to leverage that wealth into control over the fates of billions of people.
Because until we get almost everybody vaccinated globally, we still won't be fully back to normal.
Bill Gates is no public health expert. He is not a doctor, an epidemiologist, or an infectious disease researcher. Yet somehow, he has become a central figure in the lives of billions of people, presuming to dictate the medical actions that will be required for the world to go back to normal. The transformation of Bill Gates from computer kingpin to global health czar is as remarkable as it is instructive, and it tells us a great deal about where we are heading as the world plunges into a crisis, the likes of which we have not seen before. This is the story of how Bill Gates monopolized global health. You're tuned into the Corbett Report.
Department contended that the software giant had breached antitrust laws by competing unfairly against Netscape Communications in the internet browser market, effectively creating a monopoly. Bill's first concern was that the prosecution could potentially block the release of his company's latest operating system, Windows 98.
You asking me about when I wrote this email, or what are you asking me about?
I'm asking you about January of 1996.
That month?
Yes, sir.
And what about it?
What non-Microsoft browsers were you concerned about in January of 1996?
I don't know what you mean, concerned.
What is it about the word concerned that you don't understand?
I'm not sure what you mean by it.
We're going to be working together on Microsoft Office, on Internet Explorer, on Java, and I think that it's going to lead to a very healthy relationship. So it's a package announcement today. We're very, very happy about it. We're very, very excited about it. And I happen to have a special guest with me today via satellite downlink. And if we could get him up on the stage right now.
Police and security guards in Belgium were caught flat-footed today by a cowardly sneak attack on one of the world's wealthiest men. The target was Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates, arriving for a meeting with community leaders. Watch what happens when a team of hitmen meet him first with a pie in the face. Gates was momentarily and understandably shaken, but he was not injured. The hit squad piled on with two more pies before one of them was wrestled to the ground and arrested. The others, for at least the moment, got away. Gates went inside, wiped his face clean, and made no comment. He then went ahead with his scheduled meeting. No word on the motive for this attack.
But once reviled for the massive wealth and the monopolistic power that his virus-laden software afforded him, Gates is now hailed as a visionary who is leveraging that wealth and power for the greater good of humanity.
In the 22nd century, a book will be written about the entrepreneur of the 21st century. I'm sure that the person who will foremost come to the mind of those historians is certainly Bill Gates.
I don't think it's hyperbole to say that Bill Gates is singularly, I would argue, the most consequential individual of our generation. I mean that.
Our next guest is one of the richest and most generous men in the world. Please welcome Bill Gates.
At a time when everyone is looking to understand the scope of the pandemic and how to minimize the threat, one of the best informed voices is that of businessman and philanthropist Bill Gates.
The process by which this reinvention of Gates' public image took place is not mysterious. It's the same process by which every billionaire has revived their public image since John D. Rockefeller hired Ivy Ledbetter Lee to transform him from the head of the Standard Oil Hydra into the kind old man handing out dimes to strangers.
Don't you give a dime, Mr. Rockefeller? Give it a dime.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. I consider myself...
Thank you for the ride.
I consider myself more than amply paid.
Bless you. Bless you. Yes. Bless you.
More to the point, John D. Rockefeller knew that to gain the adoration of the public, he had to appear to give them what they want. Money. He devoted hundreds of millions of dollars of his vast oil monopoly fortune to establishing institutions that, he claimed, were for the public good. The General Education Board. The Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research. The Rockefeller Foundation. Similarly, Bill Gates has spent much of the past two decades transforming himself from software magnate into a benefactor of humanity through his own Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In fact, Gates has surpassed Rockefeller's legacy with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, long having eclipsed the Rockefeller Foundation as the largest private foundation in the world, with $46.8 billion of assets on its books that it wields in its stated program areas of global health and development, global growth, and global policy advocacy. And, like Rockefeller, Gates' transformation has been helped along by a well-funded public relations campaign. Gone are the theatrical tricks of the PR pioneers. The ubiquitous ice cream cones of Gates' mentor Warren Buffett are the last remaining holdout of the old Rockefeller handing out dimes gimmick. No, Gates has guided his public image into that of a modern-day saint through an even simpler tactic: buying good publicity. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation spends tens of millions of dollars per year on media partnerships, sponsoring coverage of its program areas across the board. Gates funds The Guardian's global development website. Gates funds NPR's global health coverage. Gates funds the Our World in Data website that is tracking the latest statistics and research on the coronavirus pandemic. Gates funds BBC coverage of global health and development issues, both through its BBC Media Action Organization and the BBC itself. Gates funds world health coverage on ABC News. When the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer was given a $3.5 million Gates Foundation grant to set up a special unit to report on global health issues, NewsHour communications chief Rob Flynn was asked about the potential conflict of interest that such a unit would have in reporting on issues that the Gates Foundation is itself involved in. In some regards, I guess you might say that there are not a heck of a lot of things you could touch in global health these days that would not have some kind of Gates tentacle, Flynn responded. Indeed, it would be almost impossible to find any area of global health that has been left untouched by the tentacles of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. It was Gates who sponsored the meeting that led to the creation of Gavi, the Vaccine Alliance, a global public-private partnership bringing together state sponsors and big pharmaceutical companies whose specific goals include the creation of healthy markets for vaccines and other immunization products. As a founding partner of the alliance, the Gates Foundation provided $750 million in seed funding and has gone on to make over $4.1 billion in commitments to the group. Gates provided the seed money that created the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, a public-private partnership that acts as a finance vehicle for governmental AIDS, TB, and malaria programs. When a public-private partnership of governments, world health bodies, and 13 leading pharmaceutical companies came together in 2012 to accelerate progress toward eliminating or controlling 10 neglected tropical diseases, there was the Gates Foundation with $363 million of support. When the Global Financing Facility for Women, Children, and Adolescents was launched in 2015 to leverage billions of dollars in public and private financing for global health and development programs, there was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation as a founding partner with a $275 million contribution. When the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations was launched at the World Economic Forum in Davos in 2017 to develop vaccines against emerging infectious diseases, there was the Gates Foundation, with an initial injection of $100 million. The examples go on and on. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's fingerprints can be seen on every major global health initiative of the past two decades. And beyond the flashy multi-billion-dollar global partnerships, the foundation is behind hundreds of smaller country and region-specific grants, $10 million to combat a locust infestation in East Africa, or $300 million to support agricultural research in Africa and Asia, that add up to billions of dollars in commitments. It comes as no surprise, then, that far beyond the $250 million that the Gates Foundation has pledged to the fight against coronavirus, every aspect of the current coronavirus pandemic involves organizations, groups, and individuals with direct ties to Gates funding. From the start, the World Health Organization has directed the global response to the current pandemic. From its initial monitoring of the outbreak in Wuhan and its declaration in January that there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission, to its live media briefings and its technical guidance on country-level planning and other matters, the WHO has been the body setting the guidelines and recommendations shaping the global response to this outbreak. But even the World Health Organization itself is largely reliant on funds from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The WHO's most recent donor report shows that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is the organization's second-largest donor behind the United States government. The Gates Foundation single-handedly contributes more to the World Health Body than Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Russia, and the UK combined. What's more, current World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus is in fact, like Bill Gates himself, not a medical doctor at all, but the controversial ex-Minister of Health of Ethiopia, who was accused of covering up three cholera outbreaks in the country during his tenure. Before joining the WHO, he served as chair of the Gates-founded Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria, and sat on the board of the Gates-founded Gavi the Vaccine Alliance and the Gates-funded Stop TB Partnership. The current round of lockdowns and restrictive stay-home orders in Western countries were enacted on the back of alarming models predicting millions of deaths in the United States and hundreds of thousands in the UK.
Imperial College in London released a COVID-19 report, and that's where most of our U.S. leaders are getting the information they're basing their decision-making on.
The report runs us through a few different ways this could turn out, depending on what our responses are. If we don't do anything to control this virus, over 80% of people in the U.S. would be infected over the course of the epidemic, with 2.2 million deaths from COVID-19. That 2.2 million deaths also doesn't account for the potential negative effects of health systems being overwhelmed.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home.
Enough is enough. Go home and stay home.
A statewide order for people to stay at home.
The work of two research groups was crucial in shaping the decisions of the UK and US governments to implement wide-ranging lockdowns and, in turn, governments around the world. The first group, the Imperial College COVID-19 Research Team, issued a report on March 16th that predicted up to 500,000 deaths in the UK and 2.2 million deaths in the US unless strict government measures were put in place. The second group, the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation in Bill Gates' home state of Washington, helped provide data that corroborated the White House's initial estimates of the virus effects, estimates that have been repeatedly downgraded as the situation has progressed. Unsurprisingly, the Gates Foundation has injected substantial sums of money into both groups. This year alone, the Gates Foundation has already given $79 million to Imperial College. And in 2017, the foundation announced a $279 million investment into the IHME to expand its work collecting health data and creating models. Anthony Fauci, meanwhile, has become the face of the U.S. government's coronavirus response, echoing Bill Gates' assertion that the country will not get back to normal until a good vaccine can be found to ensure the public's safety.
If you want to get to pre-coronavirus, you know, that might not ever happen in the sense of the fact that the threat is there. But I believe with the therapies that will be coming online and with the fact that I feel confident that over a period of time we will get a good vaccine, that we will never have to get back to where we are right back now.
Beyond just their frequent collaborations and cooperation in the past, Fauci has direct ties to Gates projects and funding. In 2010, he was appointed to the Leadership Council of the Gates-founded Decade of Vaccines project to implement a global vaccine action plan, a project to which Gates committed $10 billion of funding. And in October of last year, just as the current pandemic was beginning, the Gates Foundation announced a $100 million contribution to the National Institute of Health to help, among other programs, Fauci's National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases research into HIV. Also in October of last year, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation partnered with the World Economic Forum and the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security to stage Event 201, a tabletop exercise gauging the economic and societal impact of a globally spreading coronavirus pandemic.
It began in healthy-looking pigs, months, perhaps years ago. A new coronavirus.
The mission of the Pandemic Emergency Board is to provide recommendations to deal with the major global challenges arising in response to an unfolding pandemic. The board is comprised of highly experienced leaders from business, public health, and civil society.
We're at the start of what's looking like it will be a severe pandemic. And there are problems emerging that can only be solved by global business and governments working together.
Governments need to be willing to do things that are out of their historical perspective, or for the most part, it's really a war footing that we need to be on.
Given the incredible reach that the tentacles of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation have into every corner of the global health markets, it should not be surprising that the foundation has been intimately involved with every stage of the current pandemic crisis either. In effect, Gates has merely used the wealth from his domination of the software market to leverage himself into a similar position in the world of global health. The whole process has been cloaked in the mantle of selfless philanthropy, but the foundation is not structured as a charitable endeavor. Instead, it maintains a dual structure. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation distributes money to grantees, but a separate entity, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust, manages the endowment assets. These two entities often have overlapping interests, and, as has been noted many times in the past, grants given by the foundation often directly benefit the value of the trust's assets.
One of my favorite parts about my job at the Gates Foundation is that I get to travel to the developing world, and I do that quite regularly. My first trip in India, I was in a person's home where they had dirt floors, no running water, no electricity, and that's really what I see all over the world. So in short, I'm startled by all the things that they don't have. But I am surprised by one thing that they do have. Coca-Cola. Coke is everywhere. In fact, when I travel in the developing world, Coke feels ubiquitous. And so when I come back from these trips and I'm thinking about development and I'm flying home and I'm thinking, well, we're trying to deliver condoms to people or vaccinations, you know, Coke's success kind of stops and makes you wonder, how is it that they can get Coke to these far-flung places? And if they can do that, why can't governments and NGOs do the same thing?
And the charity of Microsoft founder Bill Gates and his wife Melinda is under criticism following the disclosure. It substantially increased its holdings in the agribusiness giant Monsanto to over $23 million. Critics say the investment in Monsanto contradicts the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation's stated commitment to helping farmers and sustainable development in Africa.
The study from the pressure group Global Justice Now paints a picture of the Gates Foundation partly as an expression of corporate America's desire to profit from Africa, and partly a damning critique of its effects.
You could have a case where the initial research is done by a Gates-funded institution. The media reporting on how well that research is conducted is done. The media outlet is a Gates-funded outlet, and maybe a Gates-funded journalist from a media program, and then the program is implemented more widely by a Gates-funded NGO. I mean, there are some very insular circles here.
Among the many criticisms, the idea that private finance can solve the problems of the developing world. Should poor farmers be trapped into debt by having to use chemicals or fertilizers underwritten by offshoots of the foundation?
This is no mere theoretical conflict of interest. Gates is held up as a hero for donating $35.8 billion worth of his Microsoft stock to the foundation. But during the course of his decade of vaccines, Gates' net worth has actually doubled from $54 billion to $103.1 billion. The Rockefeller story provides an instructive template for this vision of tycoon-turned-philanthropist. When Rockefeller faced a public backlash, he helped spearhead the creation of a system of private foundations that connected in with his business interests. Leveraging his unprecedented oil monopoly fortune into unprecedented control over wide swaths of public life, Rockefeller was able to kill two birds with one stone, molding society in his family's own interests, even as he became a beloved figure in the public imagination. Similarly, Bill Gates has leveraged his software empire into a global health, development, and education empire, steering the course of investment and research and ensuring healthy markets for vaccines and other immunization products. And, like Rockefeller, Gates has been transformed from the feared and reviled head of a formidable hydra into a kindly old man, generously giving his wealth back to the public. But not everyone has been taken in by this PR trick. Even The Lancet observed this worrying transformation from software monopolist to health monopolist back in 2009, when the extent of this Gates-led monopoly was becoming apparent to all. The first guiding principle of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is that it is driven by the interests and passions of the Gates family. An annual letter from Bill Gates summarizes those passions, referring to newspaper articles, books, and chance events that have shaped the foundation's strategy. For such a large and influential investor in global health, is such a whimsical governance principle good enough? This brings us back to the question, who is Bill Gates? What are his driving interests?
That you will see tomorrow, and even more of the funding for vaccine development and Fauci's funding for COVID vaccine, in fact, four different COVID vaccines, you'll see that Fauci, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, meaning the U.S. taxpayer, has been funding this research, but they're not the ones who profit from it. We will also have a whole segment on the lack of safety and efficacy of these vaccines, not just here, but we'll take you to what Gates has done around the world and show you the hundreds of thousands of people who, it is claimed, developed polio from the polio vaccine. More on that tomorrow. Now I'm going to begin what will take us a week to completely lay out, and that is challenging the misinformation from the officials around the world. And the people we're using are scientists and respected in their field around the world. This comes from the Swiss Propaganda Research. It is a quote by Swiss doctor team. Now, this team of physicians and doctors in Switzerland provided information on the current situation, and we have already brought our own research forward to show that they are accurate. So according to the latest data of the Italian, and we're going to go country by country, including the United States, of course, the Italian National Health Institute, ISS, they found that the average age of the positively tested deceased in Italy is currently 81 years of age. 10% of the deceased are over 90 years, and 90% of the deceased are over 70. 80% of the deceased had suffered two or more chronic diseases. 50% of the deceased had suffered from three or more chronic diseases. The chronic diseases included, in particular, cardiovascular problems, diabetes, respiratory problems, and cancer. Less than 1% of the deceased were healthy persons, i.e. persons without pre-existing chronic diseases. Only about 30% of the deceased were women. The Italian Institute of Health, moreover, distinguishes between those who died from the coronavirus and those who died with the coronavirus. In many cases, it is not yet clear whether the persons died from the virus or from their pre-existing chronic diseases, or some combination of both. And as I've been saying for several months, There is no good science in epidemiology and statistical analysis unless you parse off the actual cause of death with proper histological, biological, and virological and autopsies. That was not done. As a result, as you heard at the beginning of the program, in the press conference, the doctors were saying they're being pressured to put coronavirus on every death certificate. We have had at least four separate physicians on in the last week confirming that if a person dies in a nursing home from a pre-existing disease they've had for years and now are at the end stage, the cause of death is coronavirus. This is fraudulent science. That means that as an official policy, the CDC, and we have the actual information from doctors sending us these, the CDC is pressuring doctors lie about the cause of death. Well, if you lie about the cause of death, and then you look for the truth, what did they actually die from? They weren't dying from the coronavirus, the vast majority. As you heard him say, the actual amount of people that would die is 0.023%. That means that there is no more deaths from the actual virus than in the pneumonia or flu in a year. Well, we don't lock down a community. We don't lock down the world. We don't destroy people's lives. And we don't create upwards of what they're anticipating in the United States based upon the latest article I'll give you later in this summary. In fact, it's not just 70, it's 75,000 Americans, quote, at risk of dying from overdose or suicide due to coronavirus despair, group warns. This is from Mallory Simon, CNN. So they're saying that. So isn't it amazing that we could have more people die from suicide or drug overdose from being in their homes without a support system than dying from the virus? No one will be held accountable. Nobody will be criticized for that. But that's the latest statistic. So if you ask, are we all at equal risk? The answer is no. What if you're a healthy 70-year-old, 75, 80, 85? Are you at the same risk as if you're one of the people dying? The answer is clear and unequivocal. No, you are not at risk. Your immune system is what puts you at risk. Therefore, instead of encouraging people to do the right things by building up their immune system, and you can just go, if you want in information, don't go to nutritionists, don't go to dietitians, don't go to me, go to the PubMed. As you heard that woman earlier, the head of Google say, oh, we're wiping off anything that's bad information, misinformation, like vitamin C. And, well, hello. What do you want to bet anything that that woman hasn't read a single study on vitamin C and coronavirus or vitamin C in cancer, vitamin C in other viruses? She hasn't, I'll bet. Yet she will say with absolute certainty to the public, to a moronic reporter who is always wrong on these issues. So let people go right to PubMed and you'll see all the information you need on what you can do to prevent the COVID-19 virus. But they're not doing that, and that's the unfortunate part. Now, going back to the issue at hand, we have to understand we've been given misinformation, and hence by being given misinformation around the world and everyone doing a groupthink and consensus, we are doing the wrong things. We put the wrong people under surveillance. And we will be getting to the California proposition by the head of health of California that they're now going to go in people's homes and do testing. And if you should show any signs or symptoms or have the virus, you'll be taken out and put in some form of medical quarantine, even your children. My goodness. That is a big thing to do in America, is to take people when you don't know if your tests are accurate, because there is no accurate test at this moment, universally accurate, when we're seeing high levels of false positives, meaning a person doesn't have the virus, but the tests show they do. We're seeing high false negatives, meaning a person doesn't show that they had the virus, but they actually do. And who should we be protecting? The people in nursing homes or senior citizen centers, and yet we're not. We have not made any efforts to really protect them. In fact, in New York State, one of the strongest advocates for staying at home is putting people who had the coronavirus back into a nursing home, and hence everybody in the nursing home gets infected and dies because they're there to die. Now the new statistics, official statistics, shows that 1/3 of all people dying of coronavirus died in nursing homes. But what if you took all the people who didn't die in a nursing home but died because they had a pre-existing medical condition? Then you're going to see that we have made a pandemic out of what should have been not a pandemic, not an epidemic, but of concern. Now, so what we have here is, quote, less than 1% of the deceased were healthy persons, meaning persons without pre-existing conditions. So a partial overload of the hospital is due to the general rush of patients and the increased number of patients requiring special or intensive care. In particular, the aim is to stabilize respiratory function and, in severe cases, to provide antiviral therapies. But do we tell people this is manifesting in a unique and original way in a respiratory patient, so it's not showing the classical symptoms? Look at the statistics for people who survive intubation and the respiratory therapy that is invasive. Now, compare that to COVID, and you'll see that the hospitals, the doctors, and protocols are actually speeding up the death rates in these patients. Why not put hyperbaric machines? Why not give them regular oxygen and other means to increase the oxygen levels to that of a stability in a person? So there's a lot of mismanagement at this stage. I understand that. I'm not blaming the doctors or nurses. They're doing the best they can with faulty protocols. It will take all week to share with you the details of our investigation around the world, and all the people that we will be citing in our report are qualified scientists, public health officials who have spoken out, and articles from peer-reviewed literature that show how we've mismanaged this crisis. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.
I wanna know.